go through the area of Shmuel Aleph, Perek Aleph. You have to know, I just put down the entire Perek, just for general background. We're not going to go through the entire Perek. I think it's a interesting area for two reasons. First of all, I don't think that people do enough of Tanakh for whatever reason, and it's good to see that the study of any area of Torah always involves deep thought, deep ideas, and maybe this will serve to stimulate greater interest in the areas of Tanakh, assuming that you have the time for it. Also, I think it illustrates something else about the nature of Talmud Torah, and that is that there's always room. You know, people think that in Torah everything has been said, all the answers have been given, and it's just a question of studying what's been said. But as we know, if you learn properly, there's a lot of room for creativity, for new ideas. Because it's true that we have a Masora, and the basic guidelines in terms of halacha, basic guidelines, midrashim have been put down, but Chazal put it down in such a way that we still have to use our reason to get the deeper interpretation. And in this particular area, I think we're going to see that if you check the classical commentators, we are left with an unresolved problem. A problem that really has not been resolved, at least in the classic ones, the ones that I'll mention. I mean, I haven't gone through all the literature of the last few hundred years, but I don't think that there are that many people that write about this particular problem. And I think we'll see that there's perhaps we can work out an answer to a problem that basically I consider unresolved. People have tried to answer it, but if you go through all the sources, I think you'll see there's a difficulty with all the answers that have been attempted. The story pertains to Chana. Basically, you know that she couldn't have a child. It tells you the whole development over there. And Hartzara. Tzara means the other. Elkanah, her husband, had two wives. And Penina used to cause her pain about this. And finally, Chana was in Spalel. To God, she went up to the Mishkan, to Eli, and there's a whole thing about the tefillah. She was involved in a very deep level of tefillah over there. And finally it says, Vatidor Neder. That's the pasuk we're really going to concentrate on. She made a neder to God. That's pasuk Yudal. Vatidor Neder Vatoma, Hashem Tzvakos Imro'o Sira B'Yoni Amasecha, if you will see the affliction of your servant, and you'll remember me, you will not forget your servant, and you'll give to your servant Zera Anashim, the seed of man. This is a very important word which we'll get into. Then she said, I will then give him to God all the days of his life, Umora lo yala al rosho, and a mora will not go on his head. What does the word mora mean? Well, really she made a vow which consisted of two things. One is that she would give him to God. What does it mean simply that she would, what does she mean by that? She would give him to God. As we see later on, right? As soon as he was old enough, she brought him to Eli, and he was raised in the service of God. From earliest youth, he'd be devoted to the service of God in the Mikdash. But there's a second part, Umora lo yala al rosho. And what a flame shot is what? Umora would be the razor. So the expression is that his hair would not be cut. Now we know, if you know halacha, you know that that's a euphemistic expression for Naziris. Because one of the things that a Nazir can't do is to cut the hair. So, if that is the meaning then, if she was taking a vow that the son would be a Nazir, and there is a machlokas on what this means, as we'll soon see. But basically, the main objective of the Shir is to concentrate on the assumption that this was an actual vow of Naziris, and that in fact Shmuel was a Nazir all of his life. And if that is the case, then of course we have certain questions. What would the questions be? What would some of the questions be? The question, right? Good. Any other question? I'm sorry? The question, I'll repeat the question, that there's a philosophical problem, a philosophical contradiction. Did you hear that? The philosophical question is that the Rambam says in Hilchos Deos that if a person thinks that he will go to the other extreme and give up all the taivos, he's considered to be a chote, a sinner. And the proof is from the Zeros, because he has to bring a Karban Chatas, and Chazal say, because he sinned against the soul. So therefore, it's a Kal V'chomer. If a person who just abstained from wine is considered to be a Chote, so how much more so one who abstains from everything? What you see from that clearly is that Naziris doesn't represent the ideal. It's just a therapeutic measure, which is necessary when a person has gone on the wrong path to bring him back to the right path. But why, if this child is devoted to God and being raised properly for that purpose, why would she then say that he should be a Nazir, which isn't the ideal? On the contrary, if he's being raised properly, he would be living according to the correct way, would not even require a Naziris, would be totally out of place. All right, I think Danny has it. So to sum it up, there are three questions. One is the halachic type of a question, which I'm going to go into right now, and that is how? How can a mother cause her child to become a Nazir when the child is not even born yet through a vow of the mother? How does that work? Then there are two philosophical questions. One is in terms of the Bechira of the child, and that is a general common sense question. Why should the child be bound in that way? It doesn't seem right, doesn't seem fair that one person should determine the life of another person. Each person has Bechira. And how far does parental control extend? And the third question was the philosophical, because we said it's a contradiction. Our concept of Nazir is that it's not the ultimate ideal, as we mentioned from the Rambam in Hilchos Deos. Okay, let's go to the Mishnah now in Nazir. Because there is a machlokas about the exact meaning of the term Umora lo yala al rosho. Masnissen says like this: Nazir hoya Shmuel. Shmuel was a Nazir. Kedivrei Rebbe Nahoroi, as the words of Rebbe Nahoroi, Shenemar, because he says, Umora lo yala al rosho. It says in the Pasuk that a razor will not go on his head. Well, it says Umora. Now, how do you know that Mora refers to Naziris? With a Gzera Shava. Nemar b'Shimshon, it says by Shimshon, Umora. It uses the same term, that Umora shall not go on his head. V'nemar b'Shmuel Umora. And it says by Shmuel Umora. Now, Ma Mora ha'mura b'Shimshon. Just like the Mora which is stated by Shimshon in Nazir. Now, we all know that the Shimshon was a Nazir from birth. Af Mora ha'mura b'Shmuel. So, too, the Mora which is stated by Shmuel, Nazir. Same thing. Amar Rabbi Yossi, so Rabbi Yossi said to him, V'halo ein Mora, Ela shall basav adam. What are you talking about, Reza? Mora simply means fear. The word Mora also means fear. It just means the fear of man. So it doesn't refer to the razor. It means Umora, as Rashi quotes on the Pasuk over there, Umora's inish, right? The fear of man will not be upon his head. Meaning to say that Shmuel will not have fear of man, will not have fear of people. So he says, what do you mean? It doesn't refer to Naziris, it refers to the fear of man. Amalei Rabbi Nahoroi, so Rabbi Nahoroi came back to him and says, no. V'alo kfar nemar, but it also says, this is in Shmuel Aleph, Perek Tezayin, when Hashem told Shmuel that Shaul was no longer to be the king, and he was to go to the house of David and to anoint another king. So Shmuel said to Hashem, V'yoma Shmuel, Eich Eilech, how can I go? V'shama Shaul v'arguni. And Shaul will find out about it and he'll kill me. Shekvar hayo lav mora shel basav adam. He's saying you can't say that it means that he will have no fear of man, because we see later on that Shmuel expressed fear of man. When God told him to do the commandment, he said, Shmuel, Shaul will hear and he'll kill me. So he did have fear of man.
That's not fear.
Ah, all right. So well, that's the position. So it's a machlokas. It's a machlokas over here. Ain't a chinami. I mean, you're right. We'll try and answer what the position of Rabbi Yossi is. How you can get out of that. But I don't want to do that right away. I want to first concentrate on the position of Rabbi Nahoroi. Because Rabbi Nahoroi says that what? That he was an actual Nazir. All right? Let's go through then, halachically, what the problems are with this. What are the halachic problems with this position? How does the Rambam paskin? You take a look at the Rambam. The Rambam says, Perek Gimel Halacha Tezayin says, Shmuel HaRamasi, Nazir Olam Haya. Shmuel HaRamasi was a, what's Nazir Olam? A lifelong Nazir. No, forever, I mean, as long as his life. Lefichach, therefore, why do I have to know this? Why is it brought down in the Mishnah? What's the halacha? Lefichach, Omer Reini Kishmuel HaRamasi, Kiven Chana, Kiven Alkana, Kimisha, Shisei, Fez Agag, Bagilgol, Chayot Ve'elu. Therefore, anybody that uses any one of these Lashonos, he says, Hareini, I will be like Shmuel HaRamasi, or like the son of Chana, the son of Alkana, like the one who hacked Agag and Gilgal, Harezen Nazir Olam. then that person will become an Azir Olam. V'ein Omrim, and we don't say Shem Ish Achar Shem Asav Ke'elin is Kaving. We don't say maybe he had in mind a different Shmuel who happened to have the same name and who happened to do the same action. Halach is we go by the universal and he becomes an Azir Olam. So the Rambam paskins like Rabbi Nahoroi that Shmuel was the Azir Olam. Now, what is the difficulties? I think that there are a couple of difficulties over here. Rambam in Perek Beis, Naziris Perek Beis, Alach Yud Gimel. All right, he says that a katan shegiel onas nadarim v'nada b'nazir, a katan who reached the age of nadarim, he's old enough to make a vow, and he made an eder of Naziris harais and nazir o mevi karbonosav. V'yafal pishadayim olhevi shtei saros kishar nadarim. Okay, so Naziris is different. If he's not, even though he didn't bring signs of maturity, still he would be bound by the neder, and he'd have to bring a karban. Then he says like this: V'yoish madir es beno katan benazir, and the man, the father, is madir. He can make a vow pertaining to his son who was a katan benazir. Afal pishalo bala onas nadarim, even though the child is not at the level of nadarim yet. In other words, for a young child, v'ein ha'isha madir es beno benazir. However, the mother cannot be madir her child who in a nazir. He says, this is a halacha. It's simply a halacha. Because it's an exception to the rule of nedarim. That's the only neder that a father can be madir his b'nei hakatan in. So obviously, what's the problem that emerges from this? Huh? A case. The Rambam paskins. What do you do with the case of Chana? Chana was the child's mother. All right? Now, the Mefarshim spoke about this. The commentary over here brings down an answer. It's Rebbe, whatever it is, he says, and one of the answers, this is one of the answers that's brought down. Al-Karchenu Lomar, it's the commentary to the Rambam Liam. There are others who bring down the same answer. And what do you have to say? Shagam Aviv Elkanah Hiskim Al Yada Ve'Diru Gam Ho. Yeah, but the Radak rejects it. Radak brings down and rejects it. It's one of the possibilities that they mentioned. So they say you must assume that halachically, really, he became a Nazir because the father Elkanah agreed to that he was maskim, he was there. The reason why it's attributed to Chana is because she was the motivating force behind it. It was her idea. And he just carried out the halach. Tanakh isn't concerned about going into the halach, so it attributes it to her. That's his answer. The Radak takes up this answer, and he rejects it. Another problem that's raised is something I think the problem that Shalom mentioned before is based on the halach, the Rambam in Hilchos Erechin Vacharamim, Perek Vav. Perek Vav, Allah Chafav. And that's the problem of Ein Adam Makdish Davar Shlo Bo Yolam. A person can't be Makdish something which is not in existence. For example, if he says, that which my net, the fish that my net will bring up are Kodesh, Lom Aklum. He didn't say anything. Because a neder, a chalos, in other words, a certain status to take effect, it has to be on something in existence. It can't take effect on something which is not in existence.
So what did you say?
The other problem that's mentioned is that in the case of the fish, I gave an example. Whatever my net will bring forth is hegdish. That's no good. Lomaklum. It can only be magdish when it's in existence. When it's his, by the way. Here it's the case where it's not his. So it's not, as far as he's concerned, it's not in his power. So the same problem would, even if you were to say that Elkanah happened to be there, which he was there, and that he was maskim, and so forth, you would still have the problem that he wasn't in existence at the time. So how could a neder be chal on a person that's not in existence? That would be very, very difficult. When the halacha is that the father can be madir his b'nei hakatan, you assume that the son is in existence. The father didn't say that the son that I will have 5 years from now, that son shall be a nazir, is absolutely absurd. It's not in existence. There can't be any chalos. Let's go to the Radak now. relate to a non-existent being? It doesn't make any sense. Any nether. How can a nether relate to a non-existent being? The same thing from Hegrish. Hegrish is also a nether. If you mock through something, it's a nether. It becomes Hegrish through your nether. It's a form of nether. If you take a look at the Radak, Vatidor Neder, the Radak really expresses the problem, and it's on the basis of what he says that I said to you before that I consider it to be an unresolved problem. It's on Yiral. Vatidor Neder, Anitama, Echal Nidra, Al Bina. How is it Chal and her son, Shehi and Nazir? How is it Chal? Moreover, he wasn't even in existence. How could the nether be chal on him? And even if he was already in existence, Harei Amru, the Chazal said, "Oh, Ishma deres b'no nazir." The man can make the son into a nazir. He ain't Ishma deres b'no nazir. He said, even by a man, we don't have any real reason why it should be this way. It's just the halacha of Moshe Mesinai. Now, he considers the possibilities. V'im tomar, if you want to say, ki alkana osa haneda gam kain, acharesha shama meyishto, he says, if you want to say that alkana also made the neder after he heard it from his wife, zelo ra'inu. What does that mean, zelo ra'inu? The pasuk doesn't mention it. Now, why wouldn't the pasuk mention it? V'hei cheniach ha-pasuk lisbar ikar haneder. How did the pasuk simply omit the essential part of the neder? V'kasav neder chana she'eino neder. In other words, it would turn out that the pasuk mentioned the neder of chana, which was not a neder, and the real neder it omitted. That's very hard to say. Zer rachav, he says, this is far-fetched. V'yoster ani tamia, he says, and even more I am, wonder, eich lo dibu razal v'ze hadavar. Hachazal didn't speak about this problem. Because I haven't found in their words concerning this shum dava, nothing. Love of medrash and love of Talmud. So really what the Radak is saying is that he himself doesn't understand it. He doesn't have any answer. And nor has he seen. And he's wondering, how is it possible that Chazal didn't speak about something like this? In this Tanakh that I have, it's called the Musar HaNevi'im. It's similar to the Torah Tamima. That is, that he brought down the Ma'amar Chazal by each pasuk. It's kind of useful. So, you know, because sometimes it's hard to find a Chazal pertaining to your area. When he comes to this area, you know, he quotes the Chazal Amor Le'al Rosho and the Machlokas. And he mentions other possibilities. There are other possibilities. See, in other words, basically there are three possible answers. I think the Mitzudas David is alluding to them. The three possible answers are A, that Elkanah heard, and he expressed the neder, right? The Radak rejects that because the pasuk didn't mention it. Or you could say what? So let's say there's two other ways to say it, and that is to say that no, that really it means that he agreed to the idea, Elkanah, and when the child was born, then he expressed it. Okay. So let's eliminate the problem. Let's eliminate the problem that he wasn't in existence at the time. Because if you're going to say that Elkanah is the one who actually expressed it, so then you still have the problem, but the child was not in existence. How do you answer that question? So then you'll say that it means luckily he waited till he was born, and when he was born, then he expressed the neder. Or else they say that when Shmuel was born, he himself heard the whole story and the tefillah, then he agreed to go along with the idea, and he and Shmuel accepted it upon himself. Now I say that all those answers are very, very difficult. And you really, at least the Radak leaves it with, sometimes it's better to leave with a problem. And I'll explain to you why I think it's difficult. To say that either Chana can't do it halakhli because she's the mother, that's out of the question. To say that Al-Khana did it, if you say that he did it at that time, so then you have the problem of that the kid wasn't in existence. Okay? To say that Shmuel did it later on, right? When he was born, well, when he grew up, in other words. What's so difficult about that? Is that, yeah, Then it was Shmuel that, again, the question of the redactive pasuk doesn't mention that at all. You won't find later on anywhere that it said that Shmuel took upon himself a vow of zeros. I know you see he lived that way. So the question is, according to Tanakh, you see from Tarsh Balpeh, Rabbi Noroi says he wasn't Azir.
Yeah, but Rabbi
Noroi said, this is why I went through all the those sources. If you go through the halachic sources, you have to really. You have to really conclude like the Radak. And that's what the Radak said. That it's unresolvable. Halakhically, it's an impossibility, practically. And if you're going to stretch it, then it goes completely against the Tanakh. And if you're going to say that Shmuel himself, somehow later on, he heard about what his mother had promised and he agreed to fulfill it, the Tanakh should have mentioned it. But moreover, Shmuel is right. Then why would Rabbi Noroi bring his raya from Umorah? But in that case, it wouldn't be from Umorah. It would be from something that Shmuel did later on. No, very rachak miyad. Far-fetched. Far-fetched.
Well, Rabbi Noroi does not state explicitly that Shmuel was a Nozir Olam. The Rambam does state explicitly that he was a Nozir Olam. And the halacha is that when a father creates a Nozirus for a child, the Naziris falls off when the child is bar mitzvah. It naturally falls off. So if this is the case, then no matter what pshat you're going to say, Shmuel by the time of bar mitzvah would have had to have been mekabel on himself to say that this was the cause of the Naziris olam, of the Naziris la'olam, and that is not mentioned in the pasuk is a far-fetched pshat.
In Tanakh, then, I think Tanakh would be really, really difficult. And why didn't Chazal talk about this? It would be a problem that all these factors are missing. We have to posit, of course, if you posit enough things, then you can come to any conclusion, basically. But with the facts that we have, and I think Shmuley's point is pertinent, Rabbi Noroi mentions from Umorah, where according to what you're saying, it has nothing to do with Umorah. That's simply, it's not the proof. It's really because of Elkanah did it at first, and then later on he did it himself. It's like the Rambam would. It's a very, very far fetched. There must be a better way. There might could, if we can answer the question right within the given facts, without having to make all of these things. I think it would certainly be worthwhile. You see, Radak didn't suggest this possibility. I'm sure he could have made this cheshbon. That's not that hard. Because the Radak was really being very, very honest. Integrity to the great Tanakh. I mean, let's not force things. Doesn't make, he knew the possibility of the answer of saying that Elkanah maybe did it, but he said that it doesn't. My whole knowledge of Tanakh tells me that it wouldn't make sense that anyone else of Tanakh. That of normal. That he became noticed as the normal channel existence. Two, the Mora of Shmuel is Nazirus. Now, I say that here, in this Gezeirah Shavah, he's not just telling you the meaning of the word Mora. What it means is the very concept of the Nazirus is the same as the Nazirus of Shimshon. Now, what was the Nazirus of Shimshon? How did Shimshon become a Nazir?
A
by Shimshon, right, by a Malach. What does it mean, a Malach? It means it was decreed by God. He was the Nazir Shemaim, Menah Shemaim. It was the creative guy. I mean, whatever you interpret Malach, Nevuah, let's take simply Nevuah, right? So, we know that there's such a thing as a Nazir Menah Shemaim. Of course, if God decrees that a certain person should be a Nazir, that's the decree of God, then all these problems are removed, because we're only discussing it from the standpoint of human Nazirus. But we know that there is such a concept, that if God decrees through Nevuah that a certain person should be a Nazir, then that's all, then there's no problem. All right. Now, by Shimshon, it's clear that God determined that it should be Nazir Olam. But what does it mean? What about by Chana? Now, I say that the same shot over here by Chana. What's that? She didn't have. It doesn't say that she had Nevuah. That's not what it says. We have to reinterpret. See, you have to reinterpret the story a little bit. Batidor Neda, what the Neda was. It's not as simple as it would appear to be. Now, there are two basic ideas over here. The first basic idea is that she was an Akara. Akara means she was a barren woman, and that according to the laws of nature, it was impossible for her to have a child. And you see later on in the in the tefillah, the prayer that she gave to God. The whole prayer is that it was hashkacha pratis. So clearly the fact that she had a child was a result of hashkacha pratis, was intervention. In other words, according to the natural order, she couldn't have a child. That was the first thing. So what she said was like this. When she said, Vatidot, as she said, you will give to your servant Zera Anashim. Now, what is the meaning of the word Zera Anashim? Of course, literally it means the children of man, right? Children, ordinary people. But Chazal with Doresh. The Radak quotes it. The word Zera Anashim. Davaracha, there's a few midrashim. Zera Anashim, what is Anashim? Anashim Chachamim. Right? Kemodat Omar. Anashim Chachamim Munavim. She was asking for Anashim Chacham Munavim. Anashim Nevim. And he brings Psukim to support that. Another Chazal says, Zera Sheshokol Kishnei Anashim. Why the plural Anashim? It refers to seed which is equal to two men. Umayniyu, who are these two men? Moshe and Aaron. She was asking for someone who would be equivalent to Moshe and Aaron. Sheneimar, as it says in the Pasuk, Moshe vi Aaron b'chohanav. Moshe and Aaron guards the Kohanim. Ushmuel b'karei Shemo. And Shmuel was Karei Shemo, called out his name. So there's a certain equating, a certain relationship between Shmuel and Moshe and Aaron. Also, you see in the words, Ach Yakeim Hashem es Dvaro. Take a look at Pasuk Chaf Gimel. That's after the child was born. And then Elkanah used to go up to bring his karbanos. And she didn't go up, and she wanted to stay with the child until he was weaned, until he was finished nursing. And in Pasuk HaGimel, Vayomel Elkanah Isha, Elkanah, her husband said to her, do what is good in your eyes, Shavi Ad Gomlei Choso, stay here until you wean, until you finish nursing him. Ach Yakeim Hashem Es Dvaro, however, let God establish his word. What does it mean, Ach Yakeim Hashem Es Dvaro? Let God establish his word. So take a look at Rashi. Ach Yakeim Hashem Es Dvaro. Eshesha altim imenu. Zera Anashim. Let him establish his word that you ask from him Zera Anashim. What do you mean? But she already had a child. So you see that he was referring to something more. The Eli Bisucha Baruch HaKodesh. And Eli, as we saw later on, I mean we saw before, I put it on the sources. When Eli said, Yitein Hashem Eshe Lasech, God will give you your request, Bisra Sheneskabot Tfilasa. He told her that her tefillah was makubo, meaning to say that God had accepted her prayer. God had accepted her prayer. So we have to understand what the nature of the prayer was. The Eli Bisra Baruch HaKodesh, and Eli informed you with Ruach HaKodesh, Elokei Yisrael Yitein Eshe Lasech, that God of Israel would give you a request. Yakeim Hashem es Dvaro. May God fulfill His word. V'zeh l'fi pshuto, who medrash agada. The medrash is Rabbi Nechemia b'shem Rabbi Shmuel bar Yitzchak Amar. V'chol yom v'yom baskol yoytzis u'mefotzetes ba'olam. Every day a baskol went out in the world. In other words, there was a nevuah. There was a certain nevuah that they were aware of. Baskol means a nevuah. V'yomeres, and it said, Asid tzadik echad lamod. A tzadik is destined to emerge, u'shmo Shmuel, and his name is Shmuel. And a woman would have a child, she'd call her Shmuel. She'd call him Shmuel. Kivan Shahayu Rowan this Masav, as soon as they saw his actions, Hayu Om remains as Shmuel. They'd say, this is not Shmuel. The Kivan Shinoladzeh, right? And as soon as this one was born, Varo'u Masav, and they saw his deeds, Amru, they said, Doma Shezehu. It appears that he's the one. Vizeu Shamra, and this is what Eli was saying. Yakeim Hashem es Dvaro. Let God really establish His word to this child. His word that there would be a tzaddik emerging. Sheyehezeh Shmuel atzaddik. That this person would be Shmuel atzaddik. Now, if you put it all together, the pshat is there like this: that Shmuel was an Nazir Olam, and the only way that he could have become an Nazir Olam was through a decree of God. In the same way, that's the same way that Shimshon became. See, what she was saying was like this. She said that if you will grant me my request, right, you'll give me a child. In other words, I want to have a child for the sake of a certain purpose, that he should be with Hashem. And part of it will be that he'll be a Nazir. How that fits in philosophically, we're going to take up in a minute. Right? Now, if how will I know? If you will give me the child, A, which is a demonstration of Hashgacha, you see? And the child will have certain characteristics. In other words, because you can't just take anybody and put him before, you don't just take any child and put him before Ellie to be raised over there. In other words, she was saying, these are the signs by which I will know that this is your will, that it's your will that he should be an Azir. In other words, it was a conditional thing. It was subject, in other words, she was establishing certain conditions. That if such and such will occur, and these things can only occur through God, from God, Derech Hashgacha. Two things, that I will have a child, and that this child will have certain characteristics, then I'll know that this is your will. So therefore, when the final picture emerged, in other words, it's in the same way, how do we know the Mashiach? Similar to the way around the way we, how are we going to know who the Mashiach is? How will the Mashiach authenticate himself as the Mashiach? We have certain general characteristics the Rambam gives, right? Then the Rambam says, if he has these qualities, he himself is a tremendous tzaddik and a tremendous chacham. And he's a chacham almost like a Moshe and a Navi. And then he starts to be makavetz, he brings the Jews back to the Torah. And then he fights the wars. Hareyu b'cheskas ha-Mashiach. In other words, there's a certain process by which then he's b'cheskas. And then in Mosav Etzliach, and he built the base of Mikdash, then Mashiach Vadai. You see that there are certain characteristics. And at certain points, you have a certain idea, and then you know for sure. So what she was saying was that if certain things will occur, which can only be a demonstration of your will, then it'll be clear to me that that Vatidah Neder. Then it'll be fulfilled. And those were two, that the entire thing was Beruach Shini Ateva, okay. Was Ashkacha. And if the child will have certain characteristics, Chachamim, Nevonim, all these kind of mice, and that's why she waited. She waited until she saw. She'd grow up. That's what that Paschal. There was a certain Nevuah that there was a child destined to come along. But they used to check the mice, and it wasn't him. So when she saw that he had these characteristics, so then it was clear that God had confirmed what she wanted, and therefore it was the will of God. That's what Ellie told us about. Hashem was makabel your tefillah. You see? So therefore, what was going to occur was going to be a result of Hashgacha. But the final step in the determination had to be the qualities of the child. Now, if you take a look at one more thing, when she goes back to Ellie, just one second. When she goes back to Ellie, but Tomer, and she says, when she goes back, this is not Pasuk Chavav. Then she brought him up, and she brought Karbanos. Then she went, Vayaviyu Esanar El Eli, she brought the Nar to Eli. But Tomer, she said, Bia Deni, Chay Nafshcha Deni, Ani Aisha Ani Tseva Simcha Bazeh, L'Spal Hashem. I am the woman that stood here next to you to pray to God. El Hanar Hazeh Hispalolti. Vayitin Hashem Li Ashe Lasi, Ashe Sha'alti Me'imo. Vagamanochi Hishiltiu Lashem Kalayam Mashahoya Hushal Hashem Vaishtaku Sham Hashem. What does it mean Elanar Hazeh Hispalalti? Elanar Hazeh, she's not just identifying this is my child. Elanar Hazeh, we've reached a point, I now see clearly, this is exactly the child that I specified in my tefillah. He has all of those characteristics. So it's clear that it's the will of Hashem that my neder should be kept. So therefore the subsequent events was a confirmation that the neder that she made was confirmed by God. You see? So the Nazirus then is not because of her neder. Her neder plays a role. But only insofar as the subsequent Hashgacha, right, confirmed her neder. That confirmation was a sign that it was the will of God that the nether should be kept. That's what she says. Now I'm fulfilling my nether. And what's the fulfillment of the nether? He has to be before God all of his days. And part of the nether is that he has to be in his nether. So that's how the Rambam knew, that's how Rabbi Narai knew, that Shmuel HaRamasi, Nazir Olam. It was really the same way, and that's what that the Chazal did. Chazal did give the answer. The answer is found in the words of Rabbi Narai. Ma Morah Amur B'Shmuel, just like the Morah of Shimshon. So too, the Morah of Shmuel. What's the Morah of Shimshon? It was a direct decree from God. Al Yidei Malach. So too, the Naziris of Shmuel was a result of a decree from God. Al Yidei Nevuah. Al Yidei Hashgacha.
What was her neder?
What
was her neder?
Wait, what was a neder?
She made a neder.
She, what? She did. No, she would carry out that she would bring him before Ellie, and she would see to it that he's raised in this way.
Oh, but that she could talk about
it. Yeah, she would accept it. She would get out. Of course she has to participate in this thing. She has to... What she was saying, in effect, is like this. I want to have a child who will be such and such. Right? Now, if I'll get your word that you want the child to be such and such, then I'll follow suit. I'll raise him in a way, like the Shimshon had to be raised, to be away from the wine and stuff.
Right.
That's why the Malach, she's making a vow that she will carry out her part of the deal. You see? But the halachic halais of the Naziris is not because of her vow.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm. So you're taking away?
Yeah. Purely a halachic problem.
Right.
Yeah. Avi? The designation, what are you going to be? The specific. There's a specific thing. Otherwise, how's it going to be an idea? If she would have mentioned this fact, in other words, how do you know that? Let's say she would have been misspelled. I want a child, and I'll raise that child to be a Talmud Chacham. And then she would have had a child. But there wouldn't have been any specific Nazirah. She would have had, it's not enough.
It's like the prayer of Allah for a child.
And she was misspelled. And she made a vow that the child, our problem was, she made a vow that the child should be another, and in fact the child wasn't another. So we want to know how that could be. Now I'm saying that it's the way if you look into the psukim, the way the situation set itself up, it was a decree in Ashamayim. And the psukim show you how she knew that this was the will of God.
Yes, Tashkara.
I think it's a little bit similar, excuse me. You know, a similar case, although you'll check it out to see if it's identical. I was always wondering about that case.
Yeah.
You remember the case when Eliezer was sent to find the wife?
Yeah,
and
the
he's
prayer.
He gives a prayer.
That's right.
He says, if you'll be good to your servant and such, and if you'll do, and please the girl that'll come out, and she'll say, drink, and also your servant, then I'll know that God has fulfilled the will. How will you know? You see? So the answer is that he set up certain conditions, apparently. He was a spalo, and he set up certain conditions. And when he saw that these things happened a certain way, he knew it was the will of God. And exactly the same sense. You see, if you go through the story by Eliezer, he's Nispalo, but it's more than just Nispalo. He also goes further, right? And then he thanks God for doing his will. Because he saw clearly that this was the will of God. So he set up a certain situation in a tefillah that if certain events will unfold, he was on a high level, right? And if certain events will unfold in a certain way, then I'll see clearly that that's your will. Now, of course, we all can't play. You can't play games like this. This is the people, I mean, she was on a level of Nevuah herself. And Ellie told her, with Nevuah, that God had accepted her prayer. So therefore, she knew that this was from God. But I suppose, one second, why it would be that she wanted, that she made this whole thing about Naziris, that's the second question. I only wanted to resolve the question of the Radak.
She had Nevuah.
That it was the will of God. Setting up a certain thing. I'm setting up a proposal. It's like she made a proposal to God. And these events unfold through Ruach HaKodesh, you see? Through the fact that she was in Akara. She knew if you asked. Because it was the will of God. There should be another. It was a decree of God. No different than if God would have told him to a Malach. The same thing as Shimshon. Yoni?
I don't understand how, what's the use of the term neder is for herself.
We'll be Hagbish. But you can't say, I make a nether to make a nether on those fish, in other words. See, so then when the fish come, now you have to make a nether. And that's no problem.
What did you do? You took it out of the Alasa. No, you said this
all along.
I'm not going to argue against that.
Against Shimshon? Well, look, that we're accepting as a premise. Nobody, did anybody here raise a problem with how Shimshon could be a nether? No, because that's Nevuah.
That's my next one.
If a nether comes along and tells you, right, that's a mitzvah, Elof Tishmon. Oh, excuse me, Marshall has ended from way before, all right? I don't mean to work out every specific detail, why he had to say this is such a point. I want to give you my general answer is, it's the general idea, that that she knew because the event that occurred had to be from Ashkacha, that's one. The event had to be from Ashkacha. She knew that if she was in Ashkacha, and she knew Ellie was Mavasa her. I mean, so you see that it was clear to her that the event was from Ashkacha. But then how do you know the specific intention of the Ashkacha? So she set up a test, she had a premise. If an event will occur from Ashkacha, and the event will take such and such a form, so I will know that this is that the Ashkacha wanted this, and that's it. In the same case like Eliezer. So both factors are necessary. That's my basic. Another thing is like this. Why, what is the philosophy? Should a child be bound by the vow of a parent? and what about his free will, and so on and so forth. Obviously, it's the same case as Shimshon. It's from God. It's God's will. Then no problem, of course. If that's God's will, God, you can't do this for another individual. You don't know the entire picture. God's knowledge, of course, if God decides that's the best thing for you, fine.
That's a favorite question also.
What is the, But you see, but she would not have mentioned it. She would not have mentioned it unless there was certain, why would she pick that as obvious? Why pick that as a factor? We can understand. We can understand wanting to have a child for the proper purpose and he should live the correct life. But why mention the zeros? The thing is like this: that there's really two parts to her vow. Her vow. What she, the designation of the child. One, the main. What's the main idea? That all of his days he should be before God. He was given over to God. Key, right? Kol yamavu shal Hashem. All of his days he's given over to God, which meant that he was to be raised from his earliest youth in the house of God. And constantly be before God. And part of that is Umor Layal al Rosha. Right? How does the Nazirus relate to the idea of being before God? Of course, in answering this question, we also want to answer the question of why it was the will of God that Shimshon should be a Nazir. Right? That was the will of God. Then again, we have the same question philosophically. Why would God want Shimshon to be a Nazir? Right. Now, the thing is like this. Can I have a chumash there, please? What are the halachas of a nazir? What are the prescriptions? There are really three laws of a nazir. Two of them are pretty, make sense generally, but one of them doesn't. What are the two that make sense? I mean, in our general philosophical conception. He has to separate himself from wine, and not from meat. From Boston? No, just from wine.
Just wine. And he can't cut his hair.
No, just wine. Who said he can't eat meat? Just from wine. You see,
the korbanah.
What? Wine, not cutting the hair, and tumah. Tumah's mace. Probably speaking, we understand the reason for the cutting of the hair. I'm not going to go into detail that. See, they relate to his state. It's to bring him back on the road to perfection. But the next thing is why he can't be metamic. It's very difficult to understand. Softly we say that Shlomo said the house of the wise man, house of mourning. I mean, right? It's not, what will be wrong? What will be wrong? What are the specific laws? What are the laws that he has? I'm sorry? It's similar to a kohen gadol. Kol yimei azil Hashem al nefesh meis lo yavu lo avu lo imo li achu lo yachaisei lo yitam alehem b'vaisam ki nezer elokav al rosho. So you see that there is a comparison. He has the same halach of a kohen gadol. In other words, a kohen gadol cannot be metamei to any of the seven korbanim. The only exception is mace mitzvah. That's an exception because it's mace mitzvah. But the general rule is he can't be metamei to any mace, not even his close relatives. So then, in order to understand this element of the nazir, what's the idea of a kohen gadol? Why can't the kohen gadol be metamei philosophically? What's the reason? The pshat's like this. The pasuk says, "Umin ha-migdash lo yetzeh." He can't go after the migdash. Now, it doesn't only mean physically the migdash. It means from a certain state. What's the state of being in the migdash? He can't go out of that state of kedusha, it says. Not just when he's in the migdash, but he can't go out of that state. The state of the migdash is b'fnei Hashem. See, the concept of the kohen gadol, is one who is always b'fnei Hashem. He's always in the presence of God. And there, what is the hallmark of one who was always with Hashem? Complete simcha. Complete simcha. So therefore, he can't be associated with mourning. He can't be associated with the sadness of being in contact with the mace. A certain amount of sadness over there, emotionally. So the kohen gadol cannot be metamei the mace because it would detract from the state of simcha that he has to have. Constantly with Hashem, he has to be in a state of simcha. He can't take himself out of that state. Now what does it say over here? So Nazirus is not just the negative. Nazirus is not just the negative, the abstention from hair, from fixing your hair and from drinking wine, but there's a positive concept too. And that is that the Nazir represents one who is constantly Kadosh Lashem, who's Bifnei Hashem. So therefore, the same halacha, for that period of time, he can't be metamei lemeis. See? That's the concept of the that's the concept of the Nazir. Now I would say like this: What was the vow of Chana? See, the vow of Chana was, and really the whole tefillah. You see, as a result of the tefillah, God did change the tefillah. God did give her a request. Was that she underwent? She raised herself to a higher level, because everybody wants a child. Everybody wants a child for basically for selfish emotional reasons. And as a result of God, she was in Akar. She was frustrated. And as a result of that, she raised herself to a higher level. Because when she finally, what she did was that she related her own desire to the will of God. That meant that she relinquished all of the selfish. And she was saying that no, she would have a child. Most parents, what are they? What's the mother involved in? Providing for the selfish needs of the child. You know, he should be successful. They should have everything. You know, of course, it's an extension of their own selfish desires. She said just the opposite. She said she would raise a child. The purpose of the child would be for the sake of perfection. Now, what is perfection according to Yadis? According to Yadis, every individual has a responsibility. Perfection includes two basic areas of responsibility. Perfection, what's that? Well, I can do that, but then I won't. No, it's not that much longer to go, really. Perfection really is in two areas. Or you can put it another way. A person has an obligation in two areas. One is an obligation to perfect yourself. Perfect yourself. In terms of, in terms of his midos, in terms of his knowledge of Hashem, to bring himself to the proper level that God intended him to. Purely relates to himself. But then there's one other aspect of his perfection. And what is that? To the system of Hashem. In other words, that a person, you see, that's why a person has to have children, right? He has to be part of the tzibur. He has to teach Torah to others. If a person just perfected himself completely in isolation, he has the most perfect midos, and he has the great knowledge, and he's totally involved now with Hashem, he's still not complete. He hasn't fulfilled all of his obligations, because it's part of the will of God that he become involved outside of his own for the sake of others, and that's for the sake of the system. Of course, that goes back to Avraham Avinu. You see that Avraham Avinu... who would fulfill those requests? He would be raised before God for the sake of perfection. And then there's another element, the responsibility to call Yisrael. She was concerned that he would play a vital, significant role in terms of the system. And of course, you have to have a little bit of knowledge of the background at the time. We're coming out of the period of Shoftim, when the Klai Yisrael had sunk to a low level, and they became involved to a certain extent in Avodah Zarah, because they hadn't driven out all the nations from the land, and it was a period when they were on a low level. And there was a need. There was a need for a person of great stature to bring the Jews back to Torah. And that, of course, was included in her in Zera Anashim, like Moshe and Aaron. You see? Well, I'll soon explain how that fits in. Now, the thing is like this. In order to understand the second part, the Naziris fits in to his historical role. She was concerned also that he'd be the type of person that would be able to effectuate an important influence on Klal Yisrael at that time. Now, what was the Naziris of Shimshon? What was the Naziris of Shimshon? Why did God decree that Shimshon should be a Nazir from birth? Things like this. Even though we have said that in terms of the philosophy of Nazir, it's not the ideal system. Nevertheless, you have to understand that there are many things in Yadus which are there for the sake of the level of the masses, the emotion of the masses. Because people have certain emotions. In those days, and even today, you see. Now, for example, you see by the melech. A melech can't be one who's a ger. A melech can't be one who did some menial labor. Why? The guy could be the most perfect person because the emotions of the masses work in a certain way. So therefore, since the emotions of the masses work in a certain way, you have to take them into consideration. Now, it is true, philosophically, that the Nazir is not the highest level. But there's no question that the masses have a certain awe. This person has a certain charisma. There's a Nazir, one who is who lives this way, it attracts the attention. They look up to a person like that. So Hashem saw that at the time of Shimshon, it was essential in order for him to have that the type of influence that was necessary, that the people would listen and pay attention. Of course, once they listen and pay attention, the idea is to teach them the true ideas, to raise them to a higher level. But at that time, you had to cater to these emotions, and they had a certain concept of the religious person. Even today, people have these ideas. Because the Rambam says, luckily, a Talmud Chacham is not supposed to eat and drink among the people. What's wrong with eating and drinking? Right? The answer is they lose respect. I mean, people have a certain mystical idea. You have to deal with it. I mean, that's what it means, like Moshe and Aaron. They were involved in the establishment of God's system. It was Moshe and Aaron that took the Jews out of Mitzrayim. Right? And Moshe, of course, Moshe, the same thing. Moshe gave up his personal. He didn't want to be the leader. He argued for 7 days with Hashem. Why did he want to turn it down? Why didn't he want to be the leader? Because Moshe knew that in terms of his own benefit, his own perfection, it would be nothing but tremendous pain, nothing but tremendous problems. And he realized also that it could harm him even. It could lead to harm. You see, with the chait of hitting the rack. It was because of you get involved in the frustrations of the leadership, whatever it is. So Moshe really didn't want it, but God paskened that he has to do it, because he was the only one, and in terms of his commitment for the sake of Ritzon Hashem, for the sake of the system, so he had to do it for the sake of the system. So Moshe v'Aaron b'chonav. Moshe and Aaron were involved in the establishment of the system. And Shmuel b'kari shema. What do you mean b'kari shema? It means that then because of the sins of the Jews and because of problems, there reached a time when the system was being destroyed. And it needed a great leader to come around and to call the name of God and bring the people back. So that's what she was inspired from. Titli Zera Anashim. If you will give me that, what she did was she transformed herself. That she began with the emotional to have a child, and then through a process of perfection, she realized she tied it in totally to the will of God. That she will raise a child who will be perfect in every respect and who will give up his own selfish and his own personal for the sake of the arm. And that's where the Naziris comes in. Because she knew the temper of the times, she knew the emotions of people. If you study Tanakh, you see their emotions. At that time, they were on a lower level. When people are on a lower level, so then they are affected by these mystical factors. And she realized that it wouldn't be enough just that he should have the personal perfection. He had to have certain external signs. Certain external signs, what the people would really look up to. So that was the union of Naziris, Umorali Al Arosha. I tell you, man, you the Navi, whatever the Navi commands you, Elof Tishma, you Machleir to listen. Okay, that's going to be it. Making an announcement. Oh, that's crazy. There's nothing wrong. Why should I have to give in to that? And why should I have to act a certain way? These people have a false idea of what Judaism is like. Yeah, well, the answer is, of course, you have to know where to draw the line. You don't give in to any crazy idea. But you do see that there is a case where the Talmud Chacham does have to make a sacrifice. He does have to act Kesem Bevigdo. He does have to act differently, and he does have to do many things that, even though they're not objectively part of perfection, but since they are part of the ideas of the masses, and if you don't go along with those ideas, you'll lose the masses. He sacrifices the selfish for the sake of the masses, for the sake of keeping the system, not for the masses. That's a very important Musa Haskell to bear in mind. Okay. On a brief explanation, because the major objective was to deal with the problem of the Naziris. But in the Mishnah, in Nazir, Rabbi Yossi learns differently. Rabbi Yossi learns that Mora only refers to the fear of Basav Adam. So he has a completely different interpretation. It doesn't mean Naziris. It means that he will not have the fear of Basav Adam. So then Rabbi Nahoroi comes back and he asks a question. He says, how can you say that it means the fear of Basav Adam, the fear of man? It says later on, when God told Shmuel to appoint David for a king as opposed to Shaul, so Shmuel said, Eichela, how can I go up? V'shama Shaul v'arguni, and Shaul will hear and he'll kill me. Shekvaharia alav mora Basav Adam. You see, he had the fear of man. So it's a clear-cut proof that it can't be referring to the fear of Basav Adam. That's the question. That's how the Mishnah ends. So what we're going to try and do is see if we can understand the position of Rabbi Yossi. I mean, obviously Rabbi Yossi was aware of that pasuk as well. And nevertheless, it did not, as far as he was concerned, pose an obstacle to learning Pshat the way he wants to learn. So how could we answer the question on him? What's his position? Okay. He did have fear of. Let's assume that we'll call that fear of Shaul. He was afraid of Shaul. Afraid that Shaul would kill him. Now, the answer is. The answer is. Hold on a second. Hold on. The answer is that is not the fear that Rabbi Yossi is referring to. There's two kinds of fear. One fear is a fear. It's a rational fear. It's a rational fear. That is, you should be afraid. A person where the fear is rooted in reality. A person is going into a dangerous situation. He should be aware of the danger and he should be afraid. Okay? That's not, in other words, of course he was afraid of Shaul. Because a Navi, Rav Sadia Gaon talks about this. A Navi is not bounded by special laws, except if it's a specific case where the Ashkacha intervenes, but a Navi lives his life just like anybody else. He's subject to the laws of nature. And therefore, he has to take care. And he realized that he's walking into a situation with Shaul. He has danger. He has the obligation to be afraid, to fear for his life. What he was referring to was something else, an entirely different kind of fear. And what's the fear that he was referring to?
The psychological
fear of man. The fear, really the fear of public opinion. That's what she was talking about. That's what, Rabbi Yossi, Chana was talking about according to Rabbi Yossi. She was really saying that he would not have this. This is a tremendous defect. The fear of Basav Adam, meaning the fear, the psychological fear of public opinion, which is a very, very powerful force. In other words, he'd have this type of courage. Now, I just want to, it's a side point. I think Rabbi Chaim made this point recently, that he spoke about the courage of Avraham. I think the courage of Avraham really illustrates the type of thing she was talking about. Because you read about Avraham when he first discovered the true ideas, he was completely alone, and the entire society had different ideas. And you see, there were really two achievements of Avraham. One was the philosophical achievement, that he was able to see the correct ideas. But in order to have that, there had to be the psychological achievement. The psychological achievement was, of course, with regard to himself, that he uprooted the primitive emotions, but also the fact that he was able to put aside everything that society held. And that's why Chazal say, Ha'ivri, kol ha'olam bi'aver echad, all the world's on one side, v'avraham bi'aver achar, and Avraham's on the other side. Now, see, there are two ways you can really understand the courage of the nonconformist. What are the two ways? I think Rabbi Chaim is over there. They said, courage. A person can be a nonconformist, not given to society. But there are two different levels within that framework. What are the two different levels? Yes, Marshall? The two levels are, see, so that's why I'm not accepting that, Marshall, because that's really conformity. But the point is like this, a person can be different in the sense, well, how do you conform?
You don't need a person
different. There's two different levels. And one level is where it's a struggle, where a person struggles and he has a conflict. He has a conflict between the opinion of society, and on the other hand, he sees that there's another reality. And he has a conflict. It really is. It's very, very difficult, and he overcomes. He overcomes it, and it's an act of gvura. He overpowers the desire to go along with society, that part of him. That's one level. Now, what's the level of Avraham? See, his courage is different than the ordinary courage. See, the level of Avraham is where there's no conflict, where he reaches the stage where society has no meaning at all. It doesn't exist for him. It doesn't exist for him. Which one second? I'll get to you in a second. Which means like this. See, what's the? I just want to go one clarification. See, what's the cause of the conflict? The cause of the conflict is really, it's not just that a person knows that A is right. And B, he has an emotion with society. But the cause is on a deeper, the conflict is on a deeper level. It's because, you see, the thing is like this. The pull of society means that he attributes reality to it. See, a person always wants to be in line with reality. So whatever he does, he wants to be in line with reality. And when he gives into society, it means that he's attributing reality. That since everybody believes it, therefore he can't be wrong. So it's how he conceives. It's how he conceives of reality. The conflict is ultimately on the level of reality. Now, when a person reaches the highest level, so he realizes that societal opinion has absolutely no reality whatsoever. That part of him which deals with reality, it only takes into consideration the pertinent factors. You know, reason, logic, all those factors. But the factor of societal opinion just doesn't enter the picture whatsoever. It could be that there's a level between Nayach and Avraham. Somebody suggested it in the girls' class, that it's similar, because Chazal indirectly blamed Noach, attributes blame to Noach for the marvel, because he had 120 years to build it. Kimei Noach Zosli. Kimei Noach. These are as the waters of Noach. Only indirectly, in other words, the waters of Noach, that Noach is partially to blame. But not directly to blame. Why is he to blame? Because he didn't affect others. And Chazal said that Avram was on a higher level. Why? Because Avram was able to go out and mingle with others. So what do you see? You see that the Noach reached a certain level. He was able to save himself. But in order to save himself, he had to separate himself from society. He couldn't mingle together with society. But Abraham mingled together with people. He was able to help others because he was able to live together with them, and he wasn't affected by them. You know, why was Noach, what does it mean? It means that Noach reached a certain level where he was able to save himself from the prevalent ideas of society, but only on one condition, that he be physically separate. When he was in the environment, there was a danger that he would be corrupted. In other words, that's why it wasn't his fault. You see, in other words, his failure to help others at the time was not due to maliciousness. It was just an awareness of his level. Yeah, but what does that mean that he could have been affected? In other words, that he reached a level where societal opinion had absolutely no validity, had no reality, then he would not have been affected. How could he be affected? That was the level of Avram. You see, that was the level of Avram, that Avram Avinu could live together with them. And he could see all the stupidities and all the trends. It didn't mean a thing to him because it had no reality. All right, John, what do you want to say? This. So what does the machlokas boil down to? Machlokas boils down to what the neder refers to. Does it refer to Nazirus? According to Rabbi Yossi, it refers to a specific virtue. Okay? So according to Rabbi Yossi, I just want to ask two further questions. I'm sorry? When he said, that's what he meant when he said that he will not have the fear of man. It didn't mean in the sense of the fear of Shaul. Of course he'll have the fear of Shaul. That's practical. That makes sense. That's rational. I mean, Avram too. Avram was the highest level of courage, and then God came to Avram and said, Al tira Avram, anochi magen lach. After he had fought the Mulchama against the fire against the four kings, and God said, don't be afraid, I'll protect you. So you see, Avram also was afraid. Practically speaking, you should be afraid of real fear. Why did she pick out this particular virtue? In other words, according to the way Rabbi Yossi understands it, right? Part of her tefillah was that she was mispallel that he'd be a child, and she mentioned a particular virtue. I mean, there's many, many virtues that one could mention. There are many, many virtues. Question me why this? And the second question that I'd like to deal with is, you see, according to the first pshat that it's talking about Nazirus, so we understand how she, well, that was the question, how she makes a neder. Umor al rosho, because that's in her control. In other words, if God will decree that he should be a Nazir, so then I'll conform, I won't shave his hair. There we understand practically how she could obligate herself to something. But if you're saying that it's talking about the virtue, then how could she make such a neder? How could she make a neder that he would not have this fear of man? How can any person make such a prediction? How can you make such a prediction? Which is really Yesaidis. It's central. And he began to explain how. Shmuel, did you want to say something? What if you study the whole historical perspective? The days of the Shaftim, Vahivei Shafaita Shaftim. That one of the problems was that there was nobody there. People were afraid. Even the leaders, in other words. There was a lack of people that had the courage to go out and rebuke. It was definitely, there's no question that Rabbi Yossi also agrees. First, I think, let's bring out the philosophical. I agree with Shalom. You see, that you pick one thing, if there's one virtue which is central to the perfection of man, it would be this type of courage. Because what is the objective of man? What's the perfection of man? Knowledge of God. Right? The knowledge of God. Now you see in many different places that the real obstacle, the basic problem which prevents people from a complete recognition of the reality of God's existence and the relationship to God is the overestimation of human strength. We had this in the Rabbi Chait gave this year before Rosh Hashanah. Malchus, he used the term as Malchus Basav Adam. You see throughout the Tfilos, by the way, all the Tfilos of Rosh Hashanah, that was the example. It's always comparing Melech Elyon, the Supreme God, as opposed to Melech Evyon. Why? Because that is the pivotal point. In other words, the basic factor which takes away from a proper recognition of God's kingship is the overestimation of man's kingship, of human strength. And that's what people are attracted to. You see many illustrations of this. For example, you see in Yeshaya, I was just going through Yeshaya in the second Perek, when God is talking about how he's going to destroy the haughty and the mighty. You see this... And also is full of silver and gold, neither is there any end of their treasures. Their land is also full of horses, neither is there any end of their chariots. Their land also is full of idols. They worship the work of their own hands, that which their own fingers have made. And he says, and the mean man is bowed down, and the great man is brought low. It's a prediction that the powerful people will be brought low, will be destroyed. Forgive them not. Enter into the rock and hide in the dust for fear of the Lord and for the glory of his majesty. The lofty looks of man shall be humbled, and the haughtiness of man shall be bowed down, and the Lord alone shall be exalted on that day. That's the ultimate point. You see? The lofty looks of man, the gaiva of man. Gaiva really means the projection of man. Man is the one who has power. And the haughtiness of man shall be bowed down, and the Lord alone shall be exalted on that day. You also see it with regard to Mashiach. In Yemais HaMashiach, there's a number of different things, simanim, you know, that the Mashiach will do. And what is one of those things? He will destroy, he'll fight the Muhammad Hashem. Right? Muhammad Hashem will destroy the Yamalek, Muhammad Gog and Magog, but there'll be tremendous Muhammad. And it's ironic because the ultimate objective of the Yemais HaMashiach is really peace. And yet, it cannot come about unless there's going to be tremendous, you know, the Tanakh, the prophets, are full of descriptions about these tremendous battles that are going to come. Why is it essential? What does one have to do with the other? See, because the nature of the peace in Yemais HaMashiach is a totally different kind of peace. What's the basis of the peace? It's going to be because the world will be filled with the knowledge of God. Kamayim, right? Was it Kamayim, Layam? What's the term from Mechasim? The world will be filled with the knowledge of God. Now, in order for the world to be filled with the knowledge of God, so all the Rishay Arutz have to be destroyed. Amalek must be destroyed. Where do we see that in the Torah? Ki Yad Al Kais Ka. Melchama Hashem Amalek Midar Dar. What's the whole basis of the Melchama against Amalek? Because it says Yad Al Kais Ka. In other words, it's an allegorical expression. It's as though God is raising his hand above his throne. It's a language of Shvuah. But the term throne is case. It should be kisei. The hay is missing. So chazal... Ka also. Why? Chazal say, why is the hay missing from case? Because ein ha-kisei shalem. The throne of God is not complete as long as Amalek exists in the world. Why is the throne of God not complete? Because the success of the Rishayim, you see? And Amalek is the one who really stands for Malchus Basav Adam, as opposed to Malchus Shemayim. For the deification of the human ego. And as long as they are successful, so that attracts people. So it prevents a complete recognition of God. And ultimately, the only way, I mean, that's not the only factor. There's got to be other factors as well. But one of the essential components will be the destruction of Amalek. The destruction of, that's what's brought down in the description of the description of the Milchama of Gog and Magog, back in chapter 38 of Yechezkel. And it gives a brief description, I mean a lengthy description, not brief, about the Melchama of Gog and Magog, tremendous anger of God, how God will destroy all of the wicked people, and I will rain down upon him and upon his bands, upon the many peoples that are with him, a torrential rain and great hailstones, fire and brimstone. Then it ends with the words, this is where Kaddish comes from, by the way. Kaddish comes from Yechezkel. It's really Kaddish, by the way, is really a tefillah for Yemei HaMashiach. The whole idea of the Kaddish is a tefillah for Yemais HaMashiach. Yiskadal v'yiskadash, that God's name shall be exalted and magnified throughout the world. How will it become exalted and magnified throughout the world? It's talking about Yemais HaMashiach. Then it says, v'yiskadalti v'yiskadashti, v'nodati le'enei gayim rabim, v'yadu ki ani ad Hashem. So you see that the entire objective of the destruction of Amalek, the Melchama of Gog and Magog, will be for the sake, ultimately that's the only way in which God's name will be sanctified. So you see that the this particular, on the philosophical level, the fear of man is the root, is really the root which prevents a person from having a proper relationship to God, because insofar as he attributes reality to the opinion of man, to the power of man, it detracts from his relationship to God. That's one level. That's one reason. Of course, it's also true what Mitzvah said and what Shmulia said, that in terms of practical, I mean, the practical factor emerges from the philosophical perfection. The real purpose is for the philosophical. But when a person has the proper philosophical perfection, so then it's a natural result that he goes forth and he's not afraid to do battle with people. Then he can contend with them and he can rebuke them. He doesn't care. Because the thing that prevents other people from, what prevents people from going out and rebuking others is their fear, that they're intimidated. People will laugh at them. Or maybe they're not so sure themselves if the whole world thinks this way. You say, by the way, in your own life, any time that you're trying to express an idea to people, and even guys in the yeshiva, well, at least at the beginning, the biggest question that people have against the true ideas, the biggest question, how could it be true? If that's the case, how come nobody else goes this way? How come nobody else goes this way? How come that one doesn't say it? Why doesn't he say it if that's true? Now, what does it show you? Really, the question is no question. Because if the idea that you're presenting is weak or it's not true, so show why it's false. What's the difference? It's irrelevant. If an idea is false, it's false. We don't have to speak about people. All right. On the other hand, if an idea is true, then millions and millions of people thinking otherwise cannot have the slightest effect upon it. That's if a person is living in reality.
Nobody thinks that idea.
Chana, why did Chana cite this particular? Because this is the bottom line. This is the struggle of struggles. Because a person decides whether he will live in the framework of reality or he will not. Now, the entire objective of the purpose of the Torah is to put a person in the framework of reality. Because the only if he's in the framework of reality can he relate to God. Because God is the source of reality. But there's a natural the way man is designed and the way human society is designed. In order to be in the framework of reality, he has to go through a struggle. That is, he has to take himself out of a false framework of reality, which he's inevitably subject to by his nature. By the nature of things, there's not going to be a person that's not subject to this. So this is the ultimate struggle. Now, the thing is like this. The next question is about... You'll see also, by the way, this ties in with the next one. How could Chana make such a neder? How could you make such a neder? It's also true, it's true philosophically, it's also true psychologically. There's a psychological point here as well, in terms of the happiness of a person. The Rambam speaks about this. I think this came up on the Pirkei Avos this year, one of the Pirkei Avos, Ashurim. About the fact, remember the Rambam speaks about the four perfections, perfection of property, perfection of the body, the physical, psychological, and then the ultimate one is the perfection of the mind, the intellect. And the Rambam, in extolling the latter one, he says, this is the only real perfection. This is the only thing that's truly yours. He keeps putting a tremendous emphasis on the fact that it's yours. The question was, why is that such an important fact that it's really yours? And if I remember correctly, the answer was that it's a very powerful point. And that is that it turns out that the way most people live their lives, everything they're really doing is not for their own sake. It's not for themselves. There's very few things that a person truly does for himself. And again, this is a very subtle process. Because people go through, they think that they're pursuing a career and they're working hard and this and that. And it's something they really want for themselves. If they understood psychologically, they'd see that it's really what they're doing is to get a certain unconscious approval from certain images, from certain parental figures, from certain images. They could be represented by society, certain superego figures. But it's very rare that a person is doing something for the sake of the thing itself. And in fact, he pointed out that this is the machla of contemporary society. And then in contemporary society, and he tied it in, right? He tied it in with the fact of the how people look negatively at the emotional, instinctual satisfaction. Since the prevailing philosophy is that any type of instinctual satisfaction is inherently evil, right? So therefore it's repressed, people repress it. And instead of that, the only outlet for the energy is through superego accomplishments. Everything is superego accomplishment. And therefore, people can never judge, can never look at anything in terms of its own inherent value. Okay? So that's a tremendous obstacle to human happiness. Tremendous obstacle to human happiness. Now, how did Chana make the... How did Chana make such a neder? How can she say that she will raise a child and he will not have this emotion? Meaning he'll be totally free from the emotion of the fear of what people think. How could she do it? To produce a certain type of... Well, you have to understand it. I think that the... you see clearly... The basic obligation that parents have is to do the correct actions. But I don't think it's possible for anybody, even if they raise the child properly, to guarantee 100% the outcome. You're not responsible for the outcome, because we realize, yeah, you have Esav. I mean, there are many cases of tzaddikim, and their children weren't tzaddikim. Esav came from Yitzchak too. Yishmael came from Avram, and many other cases. You see, Chafni and Pinchas came from Eli, and the children of Shmuel also sinned. I mean, the reason for that is because you don't have control over all the factors, but still you have your responsibilities. Now, why this is put in the form of a net? There is a Musa Haskell over here. Because it's more than just that she was saying that she would raise him in a way. Of course she was saying she would raise him in a way that he would not have this factor. But if she said that, then she must have had a certain insight. That this particular disease, this particular machla, is really very, very much dependent upon upbringing. Because, see, this particular machla is one which is transmitted from generation to generation. And since parents are afflicted with this emotion... The emotion being that the only thing of value is the approval of society. And everything you do is just a means for the approval. So this determines how they raise their children. And children catch this disease at a very, very early age. And you could see how people raise their children. Because it's a tremendous factor of showing off. At a very early age, as soon as a child can do anything. If he can move, or he says a word, or a letter, he just walks, and everybody right away shows. And they try and get him to do, you know, they try and say they say one thing and he'll answer the other thing, you know. And when the child does it, so everybody says, oh, that's terrific, and they reward him. So you're conditioning the child at the earliest age that this is the real good. The child, you know, children sense things. They make very powerful, of course, the earliest impressions are the most powerful impressions. So right off the bat, at the earliest possible stage, and of course the parents do it with good intentions. The reason why they do it is because the child is really an extension of their own. That's what they want. They themselves have the desire for the attention and the applause, and to the extent that they could not achieve it, so the child vicariously, they achieve it through the child. By doing this, they're perpetuating something, and the child grows up, it becomes part of his unconscious, that the ultimate good in everything that you do, it's always to get that applause, it's always to get that approval. Of course, when you have an entire society that's based that way, then he goes to school, and school is even further. Because the whole system of schools is set up along these lines, competition. And you're not trained just to pursue that which is good in and of itself. It's always for a grade. And when there's grade, your grade is not on the basis of your own ability. It's always with relation to the group. And it's always a way, and there's honors, and there's being number one, and there's prizes, and competition. The entire society is established along the lines of relative reality. Relative reality, that a person should judge everything he does. I mean, there's two things that are false. First is that It's what other people think. And secondly, it's on the basis of the relative. Whatever group you happen to belong to, you judge yourself within, and that's the good. The good is to be in a certain position vis-a-vis the others. So, if you go through the entire, you see how our society today is totally steeped in this, I think to a greater degree than ever before. Because it's seeped down. I mean, I guess, I don't know all the sociological factors, I mean, it's with all the leisure, but you see that so many individuals are totally involved in these programs. You see, say all this fitness program and this and all these programs, it's not because people really are philosophical about it. You see, it's because they're looking for a certain, it's a superego type thing. It's an identification. Right? They're searching for a certain psychological approval of being an achiever, of being fit, of being this. It's all of these various things are all, they're all being done to satisfy a certain image. And there's a tremendous proliferation of this type of thing throughout all society. I think more than ever before, because, you know, things change. And I think that today, more than ever before, the idea of being a winner is a very powerful thing. So, the thing is like this. If you ask, I believe I mentioned at the very beginning, that one of the questions, if you're studying from the perspective of the book of Shmuel itself, the book of Shmuel is really, the essence of the book is the story of Shmuel, who played a very important role in Jewish history at that time, transitional phase, between the period of Shoftim and the period of the Malachim. So one general underlying question is, why does it start off with the story of Chana? The book of Shmuel begins with the story of Chana. Why? Let's get right down to Shmuel. Why do we have to go through this whole story of Chana? She was in Akara, and she went to the Mishkan, and she prayed. Right? Get to Shmuel. See, the thing is, it's easier according to Rav Yossi, we see a much clearer reason. I mean, of course, according to Rav Narai also, we see his being a Nazir and how the upbringing, there's no question about it. But it becomes much clearer from the position of Rav Yossi. Why? Because she was saying that she would raise him in a way where he would not have this defect, and therefore he would have this perfection, which is the true courage. That he would live his life where he'd be totally involved in the world of reality, and not involved in the world of people. Right? Now, since we see that this is, you know, man is predisposed towards this thing, and it's a self-perpetuating disease, parent to child, and usually the disease takes root in the earliest years, in the very, in the first encounters, the way the parent relates to the child. Therefore, the only way that this could be avoided is through the parent first recognizing that emotion in himself and curing himself from the emotion. So therefore, we see the whole process of her tefillah, the tefillah that she went through and the net that she made, was really with regard to herself. She was really saying that she has recognized this thing within herself, and she has freed herself from this emotion, and therefore she will see to it that this emotion will not come into play in the raising of the child. Of course, it doesn't mean that was the neder. The neder was with regard to herself, you see, to recognizing and uprooting the emotion from herself, and therefore making sure that it wouldn't be transmitted to a child. Now, what the outcome would be, nobody could predict the outcome, but I mean, this is what the neder refers to. That being the case, we clearly understand why the story of Shmuel begins with the story of Chana. Because the story of Shmuel, of course, we're talking about the achievements of Shmuel, which were a result of what? Of the perfection of Shmuel. But with regard to this particular thing, we see quite clearly that this perfection of Shmuel, the perfection that he didn't have the fear of Bus or Adam, was the result of what? The perfection of Chana. So the story of the perfection of Shmuel begins with the story of the perfection of Chana. Because this is a transmittable thing from generation to generation. And therefore we have to know, how did it stop? How did this perfection come about? It came about with Chana herself. Okay.